Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Welcome to the Time of Monsters podcast. We're down to the wire in the election, just half a month away. And it's a tight race. And talk about, the closing days, I'm delighted to have on frequent guest, friend of the podcast, Chris Lehman, my colleague at The Nation, for many reasons, one of which is that he wrote a very funny column, which I'll link to, about a recent event where Trump gave a different type of rally, one where there was a lot of dancing. And I wanted to ask Chris about that, because I'm sure everyone has seen little clips of it, but I think he sat through watching the whole thing and has some insights into what exactly was going on there.
Well, yes. First, I would sort of correct the term dancing. It's more discombobulated bobbing interrupted by
swaying, shouts, tottering, these sort of the old man's move as he listens to the show tunes of his past.
And a real blast, show tunes, but Ave Maria, that was sort of the big ticket.
That's like Pavarotti, right?
It's right, it's the most glam version of Ave Maria.
I think that is the period of music that, Trump is in many, many ways a creature of the sort of 70s and early 80s.
Yes.
And of one of which is his love of Pavarotti.
No, it's true. And the whole event was quite striking. It was, staged as one of these kind of town hall, Q&As with voters, all of whom were obviously ardent Trump supporters. This was in Oaks, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. And, it was a standard kind of prefab campaign event. Kirstie Noem, who's very sycophantic Trump wannabe, kind of, the governor of South Dakota, best known for shooting her dog in a quarry. Mm-hmm.
Which unfortunately did not get her the most presidential.
No, she thought that would be the inside track to the VP nomination. But Trump went with J.D. Vance, who proceeded to propagate libels about household pets.
I don't know. The whole election has gone to the dogs.
The whole position on cats and dogs in the Republican Party is probably a topic for another podcast. But so the event, was sort of going to form. There were, questions from adoring Trump fans, and Trump gave typically disjointed answers. There was a small businessman who wanted to know what he would do to promote small business in a second term. And Trump just started in talking about how Democrats want to replace gas stoves. And the theory of the case was that while Trump is going to, he's constantly says he's going to reduce energy costs by 50% and that will lower the cost of everything. Not accounting for the fact he would also introduce tariffs of between 20 to 50%, which would raise the cost of everything, but this was not really a policy event, but where it started to go off the rails was evidently the facility was sort of overheated. The crowd was close in and there was no air conditioning. So there were a couple of medical events where people in the crowd passed out and needed attention. And Trump sort of starts, first saying, everyone be calm. This is, we have great EMT personnel. Everyone's getting looked over. It's all going to be fine. But then he got kind of antsy, I guess, and then started talking about how he wanted to play music, while they were waiting first. And then he said, maybe we'll just play several songs and I'll sort of greet people as they prepare to go. And the telling moment for me was, Kristi Noem, ever the kind of devoted sycophant, turned to Trump at one point when, wasn't clear what was going to happen next and said to him, "Sir, would you like to play that song?" And Trump looked at her blankly and said, "What song?" Which was, and then she had to gently, sort of like a home healthcare aide, explain, "Oh, you had said you wanted to play one specific song to greet people." And then he just sends out a general directive to his DJ, Jason, to play some real beauties. At that point, Trump.
I thought like Kristi Noem's, you're right to call attention to that because her body language, her behavior, right. The anxiety on her face, like it all suggested someone who was like aware that like something had gone off the rail.
Right, this exactly. Was, like,
and was trying to make the best of a very awkward situation.
Right, and try to manage
I should mention, it's not uncommon in political rallies for people in the audience to have like health emergencies. This happened to Kamala Harris, especially now we're in the age of climate change.
Yeah, that happens. And we have it earlier Trump rally in Nevada, and Trump kind of heckled the people who were suffering at that moment.
Yeah,
so this was a marginal improvement in terms of his normal behavior, but.
Yeah. And so I actually think, the fact that he decided to go in this direction of, doing an impromptu, swaying to the music. Although not all of the mainstream media seems to agree with me, to me, it inevitably raises questions like, what the hell is going on with this guy and his mind? And, but one could say Trump's never been, fully stable. But if you just watch videos of him, from 4 years ago, 8 years ago, right. There's been a marked decline in his ability to speak. He often glitches. And now, he's been repeatedly canceling events and his own staff told Politico he's suffering from exhaustion. So, So one question is what's going on, and second is why isn't this the top story that the guy running for the president is
absolutely true. And just the week before, Trump did an event at the Detroit Economic Club where he stood stock still in the kind of same fashion on stage for 5 solid minutes. Nothing was happening, and it was just weird. It reminded me of the moments earlier over the past year where Mitch McConnell had frozen in this kind of distressing way in mid-sentence as he was doing a press event. So I do think there is a background here, and it's actually troubling, not only in the sense of this is a person vying to be the most powerful person on the planet, and he's not able to follow the sequence of conversations. The kind of short-term memory glitch, when Trump said what song at the Oaks rally, is characteristic of dementia. And I know, unfortunately, there are people close to me and my family who have suffered from that. And, the loss of short-term memory is a really,
it's a real sign. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's important to remember that Trump's father had Alzheimer's, and it came on with him about the same age that Trump is now.
I mean the thing with like sort of dementia is also like it's a gradual process, and it plateaus, and then you know you have dips, and reasonably surmise that you know like he's diminished now, and it was just a matter of time before the next dip takes place.
It is striking that you know among the events that have been canceled are, you know, he was supposed to do an interview on CNBC, a very friendly cable business network, with Rick Santelli, who's a total, another MAGA sycophant. And
one of the instigators of the Tea Party.
Yeah, movement. Right. No, you could say he and Trump go way back. Even in that friendly a setting, Trump evidently just couldn't face the, you know, minimal rigors of a sit down with Rick Santelli. And, you know, he did this town hall at Univision where, you know, there was a question about gun violence in schools, and you just sort of said, well, you know, we need guns for entertainment and sports. Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, even if that's what he believes, a competent candidate would not say that out loud. And, you know, he called January 6th a day of love in response to a very pointed question from a Republican who was saying, like, you know, how can you earn my vote, given that I have these qualms about January 6th, how you handled the pandemic? I think, you know, it's funny, you know, then initially, like after the Oaks rally or town hall, the Washington Post did a good sort of web recap of it that said, you know, in a bizarre episode, you know, Trump just bobs to music for the last 39 events of an event. But sure enough, the next day's print paper had a more general, incredibly euphemistic story with the headline, you know, something like Trump's freewheeling last weeks of the campaign. And it's just like, this is not Bob Dylan's second record. this is something very different, and it should not be handled as like a personal quirk. It should be handled as, you know, as the press did when Joe Biden had his sort of senior moment at the first debate. And I supported, you know, the questioning of Biden's competence and his eventual removal from the ticket. But it is quite stunning to contrast, you know, that moment, which is not that far in time, to this one where elite media outlets are scrambling to sort of paper everything over and sort of make it seem like nothing to see here. This is just Trump being Trump, which, as I, you know, tried to point out in my piece, is, you know, the problem going back to 2016, where...
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. No, this man who's like unfit on like numerous reasons is treated because he has the nomination of one of the two major
parties. Right. There is his institutional deference just kicks in, and everyone's brain goes on autopilot. I mean, speaking.
I think that's basically right. I mean, I actually think, I mean, the significant difference with the Biden case was the parties. Like, I think that, you know.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Once Biden was not able to handle the debate, then even Democrats who had previously, you know, really deferred to him started speaking openly, and that created the space.
Right. And the contrast you see now is obviously the Republican Party is completely a cult of MAGA personality at this point. Trump has, you know, the head of the RNC is his daughter-in-law, and they purged the Republican National Committee of, you know, sort of, you know, professionals and put in, you know, bootlickers, essentially. And and there's also the media component of it where, you know, you had the absurd spectacle. Trump gave yet another incoherent, disjointed interview to Bloomberg, and Adrian Micklethwaite, the editor of The Economist, you know, pinned him down on a number of questions. Trump gave this, you know, account of what it takes to make a car that, you know, is what a child would say, essentially. And you saw, you know, it was like seeing what I imagine the North Korean press. Yeah. You know, Sean Hannity went on Fox and said this was hands down a brilliant, you know, the most brilliant interview a candidate had ever given. And it, so it reminds me of the famous line from 1984, right, where the party's central dictate was to tell you not to believe the evidence of your own eyes. And that is what both the Republican Party and its, you know, media enablers are doing in this moment when, you know, that obviously people close to Trump are scared to have him in any sort of open, unscripted setting whatsoever.
It is like quite striking the level of kind of denial that we're seeing. I mean it could well be, and I don't think this applies just to Trump, that for a political party, having an incapacitated leader is an opportunity.
It's true, right? There are sharp
weekend with Bernie presidency. Yeah. If you're the person that's up, going to be keeping the corpse alive.
No, and if you're Kevin Rock, if you're the head of the Heritage Foundation and you've drafted Project 2025, you're suddenly looking at a scenario where J.D. Vance, a very loyal foot soldier, would essentially be, the shadow president doing the actual job. And that, the Republican ideologues, the hardcore people are in high cotton in that scenario,
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think, it raises certain questions about the decision of the Democrats to withdraw from the previously very successful attacks on J.D. Vance for his weirdness, and to treat him, with great civility, as unfortunately Tim Walz did at the vice presidential debate. Yeah. Because I think that's actually changing now. I've noticed in the last week, the messaging has gone against Vance again and raising the question, which I think is the right question, which is, what happens if Vance is in charge, right?
Right, exactly, which is the actual, the most likely scenario in a Trump victory. Yeah. So, I do think Vance, Vance had a small bump, though he still remained in a negative approval zone
fortunately that bump is totally diminished, it's all washed away, and he's quite negative again. Yeah. And I think that's a real opportunity for the Democrats, I think that their closing argument was just going to be about how Trump is unfit, and you can still go with that. But then also underscore, guess what? That means that this guy that you hate even more than you hate Trump.
Right, exactly. Right. And
it's going to be running things.
Wrote the foreword to Kevin Roberts' book, Trump tries disingenuously to deny any ties to Project 2025, but J.D. Vance can't pull that.
Who is absolutely a sort of tied party apparatchik to that wing of the Republican Party that everyone hates. So I mean there is that the closeness of the election, and this was the one point underscoring. I think we can agree, there's a lot of evidence that Trump, in addition to all the other reasons to oppose him, is also like incapacitated in ways that he wasn't even before. And yet it is still, this is, going to be a nail biter. This is a very tight election. There's two aspects of this. One is a sort of consolidation of the Republicans. And the other is, questions about Democratic Party strategy in opposing Trump. I want to start with maybe the Republican side, because I do want to underscore that one reason why Trump could well win this thing is that the Republican Party, for the third time in a row, has consolidated around him. Right. And that from their point of view, this mental incapacity is an opportunity. It's not a curse. Even beyond him, there's this spectrum of American plutocracy you know, that occasionally tries to distance itself from Trump. There's like a bunch of Republican billionaires who after January 6th said, well, that's it. We're done with Trump. And, right. you know, guess what? They're all back.
Yeah, they're doing the Lindsey Graham two-step, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I have to say, like, I thought, and I'd really love your thoughts on this, the Al Smith dinner was such a perfect example.
No, I know.
Of this kind of, you know, fossilized elite
right.
That one would, you know, like, if one were idealistic, what you would think, like, well, they'd be horrified by Trump because, you know, like, the Al Smith dinner is this event to celebrate, you know, bipartisan comity, right. and Trump has been such a polarizing figure. And it's also specifically a Catholic event. Al Smith was the first Catholic of a major party to run, and it's sponsored by the church to raise money for Catholic charities. Right. You know, Trump, you know, like, all that we know about him, the perhaps the most profane man ever to run for the presidency, and also adjudicated to be, like, you know, have committed sexual assault. And then at the Al Smith dinner himself, you know, like, openly, like, swearing and making very crude, racist and jokes, you know, Barack Hussein Obama, you know, like, if one were an idealist, you would think, like, well, you know, the American elite that is gathered at the Al Smith dinner, they'd be horrified by this. But what actually happened?
Well, this is, you know, it's sort of like we were talking about in the case of the national political press earlier. We have these institutions that are just sleepwalking amid conditions of, you know, secular, meaning broad ranging corruption and decay. So, you know, everyone will put on, you know, a tux and go to an event like this, and they're play acting a version of our politics that no longer exists, you know?
Yeah. So
it is, you know, I live in DC, and during the rigors of my first marriage was forced to attend many White House correspondence dinners. And those are just like the most, you know, I don't even know how to describe the level of rank corruption at at these things. You know, they're all just the political press trying to one up each other and demonstrating their access to the culture of celebrity. There's, you know, just raw sucking up to power everywhere you turn. And, you know, yeah, this is all part, in my view, of the conditions that created the Trump phenomenon, right? You know, we have a political press that just operates on autopilot and automatically sorts everything into, you know, this tinsel both sides narrative in which you're never allowed to make moral judgments or, you know, note the precipitous decline of, you know, basic defenses of human rights and discourse and what have you. And those are all the weaknesses that Trump has exploited, you know, when he was less non copus mentis. And, you know, he did it very smartly, I have to say. Like, you know, he's said, you know, in unguarded moments, he like told Leslie Stahl at 60 Minutes, like, well, the reason I attack the press all the time is that it will discredit the press when you report something negative about me. And
yeah,
and it worked. It worked on both fronts. It it engaged his base to go after, you know, the press with violent threats, and it made the press, you know, automatically deferential and cautious. Every time Trump would do something outlandish, they would run off and make excuses or downplay it. You know, even before this event, I wrote earlier this week about a idiotic column in the New York Times saying that, you know, there is a significant segment of Trump supporters who don't believe he's going to do what he says he's going to do. You know, when he talks about locking up the opposition and turning the military against them, or, you know, 200% tariffs or whatever. And it all goes back to Selena Zito's famous dictum from 2016 that Trump supporters and by extension the press should take Trump seriously but not literally. And in 2016, that was a disastrous piece of advice. You know, Trump got into office, first thing he did was institute the Muslim ban. That was pretty goddamn serious and literal. And, you know, and he went after his political enemies in all the ways, you know, he tried to, you know, auction off aid to Ukraine for dirt on Hunter Biden, you know.
Yeah, he is.
And, you know, for to be this far, you know, nearly a decade later, and having the press pull this same bullshit.
It is. Yeah, no, no. I actually thought I was very much struck by a comment that Joseph Kahn, the executive editor of the New York Times, made, where he said, oh, yeah, he does absolutely believe that Trump is an authoritarian threat and who will endanger the press if he's reelected. But if you take that comment, but then you actually look at the New York Times coverage,
you would never know. So
it's actually, I mean, in some ways, not unlike the, you know, Democratic Party. Like, they're not even willing to, like, do what's necessary for their own existential survival.
Yeah, like, and that is why I think you have to look at these matters from the viewpoint of kind of just complete institutional atrophy. You know, institutions are not, they don't know why they're there and they don't know, you know, what interests they're supposed to serve. And so they are easily throttled by strongmen like Trump who do know what they want.
I think that's very right. And that's why I thought, I mean, I was really struck by the Al Smith dinner, just because it is such an anachronistic kind of event.
I mean,
first of all, I have to get this off my chest. Like, why are we honoring Al Smith, who, like, of course, a Catholic pioneer, but after that, like, a total reactionary.
No, he was a bitter foe of the New Deal. He presided over, you know, just unbelievable rampant corruption in New York.
But leaving that aside, the actual dinner itself, the actual event, it's even like functioning well, is like, it seems like this sort of like Dean Martin roast from like the 1950s.
You know, the DC version of that is the Gridiron. I was talking about the Correspondents' Dinner, but the Gridiron Club is the same thing down here. And they're just, I went to one of those and I could not get drunk enough to like, trauma of that moment.
These kind of gatherings. I would actually encourage people to look up the photographs of the Al Smith dinner. It's actually quite disturbing to see, you know, Donald Trump giving his like fisted thing, you know, surrounded by
bootlickers again. I think of these events as kind of infomercials for class revolution. They're all doled out, you know, decked out in white tie and they're just, you know, enjoying their privilege in a way that is completely indifferent to the ordinary experience of the people who are supposed to decide the outcome of the election. It's disgusting in a way that is hard to articulate forcefully.
Now, to maybe close this out, though, I mean, like, you know, as I mentioned, you know, nail biter of an election. Right. And I just wanted to, like, get a sense of where you are in terms of, like, you know, where things stand. Because, you know, like, I don't want to be like totally negative. Like, I think
Kamala Harris is.
Harris has done a few things like really right. I thought her decision to go on Fox was actually quite good.
Right.
She's really out there. She's been needling Trump about the stuff that gets him worked up.
Yeah, she's playing audio clips of his deranged statements at her rallies, which I think is a very smart move.
There is a way in which this is a strong closing, I think she has campaigned much more vigorously than either, you know, Joe Biden, you know, admittedly under COVID, but certainly much more vigorously than Hillary Clinton in 2016. Having said that, all that, like, you know, I've raised questions like, you know, like, is the strategy that they're going for at the last minute, which is, you know, to close out with a pitch to Never Trump Republicans, like, is that the best pitch that they can do? Or, you know, I mean, I think if things go really bad, you know, I think the question will be, you know, like, what was the alternative policy, which would have been like sort of engaging with the base and trying to energize the base and to do a real turnout operation. Yeah, I mean, we don't know. I mean, like, we will find out when the, and I'm very much open to the idea that this is this strategy could work. You know, it's a risk. It's a real gamble that they've taken to, I think, prioritize these suburban former Republican voters over a base engagement strategy. But I mean, what's your sense of this?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of dictums I've used to characterize our political scene generally. One is, you know, in some ways, the most significant difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is, you know, Republican leaders are afraid of their base, basically, and Democratic leaders hate their base. And that set of presumptions informs, like, a lot of the decisions that get made in both parties. You know, Republicans will appease their base because they're scared of what they might do. They might primary incumbents, they might, you know, stage another violent coup, whatever. And Democrats have this view that their base belongs to them and they should be scolded and disciplined.
Which we saw a little bit of, like, with Obama's approach to black
voters. Right. It's a very bad impulse. And it's,
yeah,
it goes back, in my view, to, you know, the dawn of the Clinton era, where the whole neoliberal project was to demonstrate that the Democratic Party was grown up and had a business sensibility and had to distance itself from party activists who were deemed special interests in this, you know, stigmatized way. And so you had things like the Sister Soldier moment, which every candidate since then has tried to replicate in one way or another. You mentioned the Obama thing of scolding black voters for, you know, having potentially misogynistic reasons for not rallying to Harris. And it's just, it's very frustrating. And I think that, combined with this pitch for centrist / Republican, Republicans who are disaffected with Trump, you know, a couple of things. I do largely believe, you know, as a result of, Trump is more a symptom, but we live in an age of negative polarization where the traditional kind of closing argument in a general election that both major party candidates need to move to the center to win independent voters, those independent voters largely don't exist anymore. The ones who say they're independent are often lying.
They're voters who don't want to declare, but they definitely have their sympathies and directions.
It could be, I do think where the Harris strategy could potentially be effective is it's exploiting the weakness of the Trump campaign's theory of the electorate and its ground game, which is to say, going back to when Biden was still the nominee, the leaders of the Trump campaign decided to go after what they call low propensity voters, which are largely young white guys who aren't normally mobilized in the same way other constituencies are. And, you know, they have this exotic theory about how they can get them all to act at once. And so far, early voting returns don't show that that base has been mobilized. Early voting shows gender gap than polls were showing. So I don't think that's working. And I think what Harris is doing by going on Fox and doing these sort of events, you know, she's done a lot of podcasts that, you know, sort of young stoner white guys listen to.
She might go on Joe Rogan.
And that theory, I think, is they're trying to sort of put a lid on that base that Trump is reaching out to.
That makes a certain degree of sense. And I mean, that's perhaps the other aspect we can kind of close out on, which I think you know, in a tight election might be decisive, which is a sort of ground game issue. And as you mentioned, you know, the RNC has become this kind of like just another Trump operation, which means like it's like badly.
Yeah, now it's branding and it's not delivering, right?
Yeah, and you know, they do have outside money like Elon Musk and the Koch brothers, but it's not clear that those they also either they have a ground game either. Yes. Whereas conversely, in theory, you know, there's some people are questioning this a little bit, but I mean, in general, the theory is that the Democrats will have a pretty good, strong base, certainly in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and, you know, one hopes in Pennsylvania. Right. So, I mean, and that could, like, decide it. Like, if you can actually get, you know, a ground game can, I think, bring out low propensity voters better than podcasting. And I say this as someone who's speaking on a podcast.
Yeah. I'm not sure how many votes you and I have moved to be.
Yeah. Or even how many votes. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like Joe Rogan, I have to imagine that like a large percentage of that audience is stoned out of their mind when they're listening to them. I would certainly hope so. Age of, you know, where cannabis is legal in large parts of America. I don't think that this is necessarily a voting base that could locate the voting booth, that could remember the date of the election. So, knock on wood that, you know, this targeting of low propensity voters doesn't work. But anyways, that might be a good note to sort of end on. I want to thank Chris for being on. We will soon find out the results of this election. As I said,
soon. I don't know, maybe.
Let's hope before the Supreme Court gets to it.
Right.
So, but again, I want to thank Chris for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.